Hi, friends. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Marley. By the grace of God, this fellowship, and many, many people, I've been sober since September the 17th, 1978. And for that, I'll be eternally grateful. I'd like to thank the committee for having Jeanette and Melissa and I here. And I believe Milton and Joanne probably inspired the committee for me to share this morning, and I'll wait and thank him later. But I was told early in my sobriety that I should be always ready to give back a little bit of what's been so freely given. And I'll do the best I can to share a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. Just to sort of help you identify with this alcoholic, I'd like to tell you a little story. This person was having psychological confusion and went to the specialist, and they said, well, we believe that we can do a brain transplant and we can turn things around for you. So you go over to the medical center and you'll have to select who you want to be. So he got over there, and there was a number of transplants available, and he said, well, what are these? And so, well, they're the brains of truck drivers and blue-collar people, etc. Well, how much is one of those? $500. And he said, what about those ones next? Oh, they're doctors and lawyers and car dealers, important people. They're $1,000. And there was one sitting over in the corner. He said, what about that one over there? They said, oh, that's the brain of an alcoholic. It's never been used. It's $5,000. And, Lordy, I used my brain for a long time in the wrong direction, but anyway, God shown me a different way of life, a new way of life, and I was born up in the snow country. I don't know if our chairperson drank any of that special Canadian stuff, but I drank that they call block and tackle. Take a drink, walk a block, and tackle anything. But anyhow, I had wonderful parents. Our home was a home of love, but it was never said. It was shown. I don't remember my daddy, or until I got sober, there was never that word used in our family. But since then, it's used quite. My mom and I, and kids and grandkids, and great-grandchildren. I have two great-grandchildren. And that's truly a miracle. My grandchildren has never seen me drink. My youngest son doesn't remember me ever drinking. They've all gotten married with me in sobriety, and that's amazing that someone could get married and be sober. You know, like, and I've tried numerous times of being married, and it takes a lot of determination to do some of the things I've done until you get it right. And I'm having a great life today. Anyway, I had an older brother and two sisters and then two brothers, and I was different. You know, I rebelled early. I didn't like teachers. I didn't like it when I was told to do things. I wanted to do things on my own, and I was a good doer. I would do. And as you know, I cut lawns and shoveled snow and done all the things and bought my own clothing from when I was a young fella. But the first time I remember getting involved with booze, I was probably about 13 or 14. And they used to have, they still have the booze, it's called lemon gin. and it had a sticker on the bottle, not to consume without mix. And another young guy and I, we drank that stuff straight and chased it with beer. And gosh, I can't say I enjoyed it. Someone here this weekend talked about getting sick and getting sick. And, you know, I guess I always get sick, but I mean, physically it was terrible. I really, really had to work at getting to consume that powerful stuff and not be violently ill. Because I was for a long time. And I would hang on to the grass to keep from falling off the earth. You know, I just, it was awful. It was awful. And those beds, I remember I'd sneak in the house at night and that bed would flip upside down and all over the place. And it wasn't too long until the cars were doing the same thing. It was just, you know, and I was just flippity-floppy as could be. But I had two uncles, and they were special to me. They really shone. The one, they were good workers, they dressed well, they drove fancy cars, they had nice girls, and I thought, man, oh man, that is who I gotta follow. And these uncles were my heroes. I was reading a book this morning about heroes. And by the grace of God, the one uncle is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. He's sober the same length of time as me. And he's had a lot of tragedy in his life. The other uncle, the younger one, he's passed away as a direct result of alcohol probably 5 years ago, 6 years ago. So I followed these guys around, and I drove the getaway car in a couple instances. We were wild. And some people end up on the riverbank drinking wine. My uncles and I started there. We started with Catawba and all that trashy stuff. I mean, that's what we drank. And we were great fishermen, and we fished with dynamite. It was instant gratification. You know, we wanna, like, if we're gonna get some fish, let's get them. And of course, you know, my priorities were totally wrong. I mean, it was just and this was to continue with my attitude. You know, I liked girls and cars, and I'd have to mention that. And at the young age of 17, I got married. My friend, I call her the children's mother now, and we have a good relationship as ex-wives can be, and she finds me quite hilarious that I'm sober, and I put that poor girl through hell on earth. It was awful. And then she got to return some of that stuff too, and that looked good on me. You know, it hurt, but it looked good. But at 21, I had three children. I had started in the trucking industry. I was a teamster when I was 17 or 18, and it enabled me to be with older men and be recognized with a uniform, and I could go into the hotels. And I started having driving problems, and the judge up there, he ruled four courthouses. And my travel area was in that jurisdiction. And it wouldn't matter which court I was going to, I was facing the same man. So, you know, his name was Magistrate Baxter. And he was good to me. He seemed to like me. And he'd even allow me to drive at work and to and from work and not any sociable driving. And the only time I would violate his rulings was when I would get drunk. And that was a pretty regular occurrence, believe me. But you know, I was always a worker, and I was I thought for a long time a real good provider, and financially I was. But the other things became secondary when I drank. Drinking was what I want it to do. And by now I was starting to be able to consume it and not get sick anymore, physically, but mentally it was getting worse. And I don't know how many times I lost my driver's license. I don't know how many cars I wrecked. But if I had a grandchild or someone behaving the way today that I did then, I would certainly think they I should get them some help. I would buy a new suit of clothing, get drunk, and burn it. Or I would trickle in the trousers. I would buy a new car and I'd immediately upset it, and I'd be paying for two or three cars at once and only have one for a while. Anyway, as you can see, my priorities and confusion. I took a geographical cure, which I didn't know at the time. I transferred with the trucking company to a city where actually Jeanette grew up. And it wasn't long until I was behind the hotels with the truck in that area, and things got crazy. And I seen these big fancy trucks. And trucking's a disease almost. It's really... And my story, I'm not prepared to change anything about it. Anyway, I've seen these big rigs on. You know, I could be a good daddy if I just gone all the time and riding up and down the road. So I took off. I got my age changed and my license. I wasn't old enough. And I got running fresh fruits and vegetables from Toronto to Florida and return. And horror stories. I met a guy early in my sobriety, in my driving, on that run, and he taught me how to be a real gentleman trucker. Now, we would be in a bar and we would be drunk, and it wouldn't matter where, and someone, be it the barmaid or a lady, would ask what we'd done, and we were highway transportation engineers. And we dressed well, and we smelt good most of the time, except for that booze. And he showed me how to be very dishonest. And we became just unbelievable, the things we'd done. See, we would check into a motel and have a shower and a swim in the pool. And when the lights went out at night, we'd back our truck up in the pool area. And those poor people would have no furniture, no lawnmowers, nothing, anything we could get. We would go up the road and tip the waitresses and buy lots of booze. And we got doing some barbiturates, or it's certainly drugs. It certainly fried my brain. I became even more confused. So I got so sick physically. And the company I worked for respected me and knew I was a good guy, but they didn't know what they were going to do. And they needed a manager or sales dispatch operator. And I got into management. And it was quite a change for me. Financially, it was a lot less money. The stealing had to stop. That was a lot of booze money. And you know, I'd done well. I'd done very well. I got a company car, I got credit cards, expense accounts, I became sales manager. Everything got good. And then I got bad. And I put those people through hell. It was a family business, and oh gosh. I'm glad that my company doesn't have me at that time working for us. But they would talk to me, and I had a lot of pressure, and I worked hard, but I had a nice home. I'd moved back to my hometown, and had a nice home and new cars. Everything was good, except me, and it got quite serious. The heat was on, and I decided to go and sell trucks. I thought, well, I'd be better selling trucks, and they didn't want me to go to work for competition, so they helped me get into a good dealership. And my drinking got worse, because I was now, you know, free to have longer lunch hours and later starts and early retiring. And I had expense accounts, and I was so dishonest. I had a base salary and expense account. And I remember I used to always worry if I put Milton's name on my expense account that they might call him. And it wasn't long till I was at the cemetery taking the names off tombstones on my expense account. I figured they haven't got a phone line to that poor sucker. I got no problems there. But anyway, it was a terrible way to live, just terrible. And I was coming off a drunk in Toronto. I have to tell you this part of my story because I had some great success. I was coming off a drunk in Toronto and a guy locked his keys in his car, and he'd heard about me. He knew the family I'd worked for years. And he said, I have a company I'm going to close down, a trucking company, or bankrupt it. He said, if you'd be interested, I'll give you half of it if you want to pick it up and go with it. So he made me his partner. Gosh, we made some money. Big fancy things. Terminals all across Canada. And I would get so bad, I'd sit in the airport and hear my flight called, and I'd just let it go, and then I'd be on the phone canceling all my meetings and changing everything. I would go to Chicago but be in Mexico. I was still married, but not very well married, to say the least. But I started breaking out in spots, and like, you know, just everywhere but where I was supposed to be is where you'd find me. And going back to my parents for Christmas Day or a celebration, they would have to come and get me out of the bootlegger joint. My priorities all changed as soon as I drank. And the more I drank, the more it changed. And I always wanted to be someone else. And if I could get a hold of my boss's business cards and be in the bar drunk, I'd be him. And if it was a lady of the night, I'd give her his card and say, call me tomorrow, I'll be in the office. And I'd stand by his door and hear this prostitute on the phone trying to talk him about she was to call him today. And I just put those people through terrible, terrible behaviors. Never wanting to be me, consequently, it got worse. It really got... the more I made, the worse it got. I finally got tangled up with some mafia people, and that wasn't to my advantage because I was now filled with so much fear. I had so much fear, and I was carrying a revolver everywhere I went. And it was awful. And fear brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, nothing but. I was just filled with fear, fear of the unknown. My one uncle, who's sober the same length of time as me, met me at my niece's wedding, and he said, you know, there's a better way of life. And I was like, I was wound up, and he said, you could come to AA. And I said, nothing wrong with me. And at that time, I was on Valium, and I was drinking excessively. And I was having a lot of hot flashes, so I was having a lot of nudity in my life. And I would arrive at parties in my nude, and I would be in my car driving in my nude. It was just hot flashes. And I was getting worse because I would sometimes find the drapes in your home would be easier to urinate behind than the washroom. And I was the kind of a guy, if I came in and it was in the winter, I'd shut your furnace off for you. And if it was in the summer, I'd put it on for you. I was always, I was addicted to fire alarms. When I was a young fella with my first car, whenever I would arrive back in my hometown drunk on a Saturday night, I would always go to the fire hall and break the glass and set the alarm off. And my friends would always know I had a back. I was And I had a lot of problems over that. And it got so bad, here's a man in his 30s, wandering around Montreal, Chicago, wherever, and I would excuse myself from whoever I was with. I wouldn't even tell them what I was doing. I'd just shoot in a doorway, set the alarm off, and continue on. And when I had this company across Canada, I was down in Moncton, New Brunswick, and they'd build a big fancy hotel there, and I was there with my managers, because I had a lot of employees. I had a big business. Here's a lunatic. And I went to the ice machine, and the alarm went off. And then I went down to the pop machine. I had a hospitality suite, and I was wandering around, and the alarms were going off, and the firemen showed up at the door, and they said, "Someone in here?" "No, do you think I'm crazy?" Well, I didn't realize they had video cameras. So that night on the way to the, I kept doing it. And that night on the way to the ballroom dinner, I noticed I was picking up speed, and I had a guy in each arm, and I didn't know them. And I went to jail. And I'd been in jail before, and I never ever was impressed with being in jail. I didn't like it. I didn't like the tin cups, and I didn't like the way they treated me. They weren't nice to me. So I ended up in jail that night, and the fear and I was so embarrassed. And the next morning I just went, didn't even go back to the hotel to get my clothes, I just went to the airport and left. And that fire alarm thing, I used to make a talk on it. And one night I was speaking at a guy's 5-year, and they called me up after, and they said, "We want to make a presentation to you, Morley," and they present me my own personal fire alarm for me to set up. But it was certainly insanity for any person to behave that way. And I'd met another guy that told me his AA story. He was involved in money, and I needed lots of it for finance, and he had a wallet so large, and it was just filled with credit cards, and he handled only $1 million loans, and his name was Bob D, and he told me about living in a car in New York with his daddy, and the horrid life, and he had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous and found a new way of life, and here he is now. A shining example of a responsible man with a lot of trust. And I thought, that's cool. So as things closed in on me, I thought of Bob and thought of my uncle, but my uncle was back out drinking, so he wasn't too good of an example. But anyhow, I thought of Bob, and I had sold my business in a blackout. I had nothing. No one would hire me. I wasn't in demand. I didn't have a wife and family anymore that lived with me. I had a girlfriend, and which later became my wife in sobriety, but that was in terrible, terrible shambles, and it should have never happened, the marriage, but for whatever reason it did. But I was a mess, and I was prepared to start another business. It was something I had to do, and I wanted to do on my own. And I was organizing to do this, and I was 39 years of age, and I was still screwed up in my priorities. But I had a guy putting some money in, and it could happen. And on the Friday, they were to hook my phone up, bring in some furniture, and get me started, like for the Monday morning opening. And I was drunk, nothing happened. So Monday morning, I arrived at this. Well, I should back up a little. I'd been in the wrong place again with the revolver and the people, and I woke up Sunday morning, and Sunday mornings have always been special to me, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous. That Sammy Smith sang that song, "Sunday Morning Coming Down," and I was always in trouble Sunday morning. And I've always done a lot of Sunday morning meetings. And Milton asked me when I want to speak here, and if I had had my choice, I probably would have said Sunday morning, because Sundays are special. Because I was always trying to drink all day Sunday and function on Mondays, and it never did work. I would be drunk. But anyhow, I had a moment of truth, something, God intervened, and I kept on drinking, went back to my sister's where I dropped my girlfriend and her little baby off the day before for an hour, and it was the next day, and I said, come on home, I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was drunk, drinking, I had that country music playing in the car. Nothing had changed. I was just going to go to AA. I could take you to the spot where I threw out my last beer bottle, because I always drank and drove. And I was on the beer that morning. Anyhow, I phoned, and a guy by the name of Earl S. asked me some embarrassing questions, like, was I okay? Of course I was okay. Was I drinking? No, I wasn't drinking. I was drinking tea. Because we had made me a pot of tea. He came over that night and took me to a discussion meeting, and would it come my turn around the table? I said, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Because I knew that every time I drank, or any trouble I ever had was when I drank. When I didn't drink, I was okay. So anyhow, that got me started, and I started looking around and found a group of people that I really, really liked. And on that Monday morning after my disaster, my insurance man came to sign the policy for this business I was starting. Excuse me, he had to sit on his briefcase. I had nothing in the office, but it got started. And it's a good business today. It's a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. They've loaned me that business, and it's been good to me and my family. I was a slow learner in AA and never went back out. But I didn't have my priorities straight. I wanted to do my business things too much, and I was hesitant to go. But I always went to my group Friday night and Sunday morning. Always. That was my church, was AA. I would tell my Jewish friends who didn't celebrate their Sabbath on Sunday that I always had to go to church Sunday morning, so I couldn't meet with them or do any business. So it started to work, and I started to meet the people that I needed to meet, and things got good. I started to feel good. The doctors were impressed. My family stopped turning the lights off when I drove in the driveway. So things got good. The kids started hanging out. They'd always been my friends because they liked some of the things we'd done. My oldest son and his girlfriend, which later became his wife, I took them on a drunk to the Indianapolis 500 one year, and it was a disaster, but they had fun. Because, see, I fell down 20-some flights of stairs, and it was all a mess, and out in the street getting my picture taken with the biggest colored police officer, I guess the first one I ever seen, and I told him how much I liked him. And you know, went to sleep on the lawn, and they had to go get the car and come and get me. No, it was, things started to change, shortly after, you know, I started to read. I started to really be interested in this fellowship. Then some miracles happened. I'll tell you about this one guy who I still sponsor. I was sober a year or so. I was at a Saturday night meeting, and I heard some people saying, that SOB will never make it. He's just a drunk, and he'll die drunk. He's been to every... He'd go to Boston. His parents had money, and he would go everywhere and come off the plane drunk. And they said, and I went over and intervened, and I said, who is this guy? And here I am, so to speak, full of it. And they gave me his name and told me where he lived, and I got my first sober Cadillac that week And I didn't want to go up to his house because he lived way up a gravel road, but I went anyway. Got there, and his son answered the door, and I said, I was from Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to see his daddy. And he said, well, he's passed out. So I don't know why, but on the Monday morning, I sit in my office, I better phone him. So I phoned him, and his name's Ross W. And Ross, when I went to see him, he was a mess. And he said, I don't want to go anywhere. If you'll, I've heard of you. Now, he heard of me through some things I'd done in AA that I wouldn't recommend, because some of my friends in AA would be getting married, and I'd open my shop where I repaired my trucks, and we'd have big stag parties. Well, there was no booze, but there was a lot of games and other things. And some of the old-timers didn't like me being sober, behaving that way, but the people got married, and they had fun, and we had fun. So I didn't do everything right the way I would recommend it, but we stayed sober, and we had a lot of fun. My first sponsor, who's deceased, he said, there's happy sobriety and sad sobriety, and I suspect that you would want to be happy, so try to apply a little smile in your face most days, and stick with those sober people. And I started doing those things. And I got Ross with me, and he inspired me, like Melissa is now, to be at 2 and 3 meetings a day if possible. So Ross and I are rocking and rolling in the meetings, and he's getting well. And he was sober 8 or 9 months, and his mom and dad were still alive, and he had to go to Europe. He's in the booze business. And I was down at their place, and they said, oh, Mr. Black, he'll be so drunk. He might never come back. And I went home, and I said to my girlfriend, I think I'm going to Europe. Excuse me. And here I got a new business. I got priorities. But anyway, I said to Ross, let's book a flight. I'm going with you. So we're over there, and we're down on a side trip in Spain, and for a weekend, and Ross said to me, how can I ever repay you? And I said, Ross, you don't got to repay me. You already have. I'm sober, and I'm in Europe. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be here. So he said, no, I'm going to do something. He says, you got all those trucks and no business to speak of. And we got back, and he called Molson Breweries, and that's Canada's largest. And it wasn't months until my fleet was painted Molson colors, and I was hauling beer, and here I am, a member of AA, and all the old timers are saying, you sucker, you'll be drunk, you can't haul beer. And I used to have loads and loads of it, and I'd be inspecting loads, and we'd be upsetting loads, like we had accidents and things, and it was, I used to call it wobbly pop. You know, that was, I never identified that it was, because I wasn't tempted. I didn't want to drink anymore. I didn't want to do those things. And anyhow, as a direct result of a 12-step call or helping a fellow alcoholic, I ended up, you know, being Canada, one of the recognized beer carriers. And I still have a lot of beer and wines and coolers and stuff. So you never know what this program's going to give us, and it's up to us, I believe, how we accept any opportunity. And life is filled with opportunities today for me. It's an opportunity to be here, but it's also an opportunity to employ my children, have lots of fun, make a couple of bucks. I'm not obsessed with making money. I don't need money. I want to be just allowed to be in business and have fun. So my priorities changed, and AA kept introducing me to people, people that, no different than last winter, I would never have been here, Jeanette and I, in the spring and now again in the fall, if we hadn't gone on the cruise without booze last winter and met Milton and Joanne. It's the only way we got here. So another time when I was in Europe with Ross, we went to, there's an English AA meeting every night of the week in the American church in Paris, France. And here I'm his sponsor, and I'm saying, we got to get to a meeting every night. And we went to the meeting, and there's a couple of Southern boys there. And after the meeting, I went and introduced myself and talked, said we're from Canada. Excuse me. And the one gentleman, his name was Doc Crandall from Atlanta, Georgia. And Doc became almost my God. I mean, that man could say anything to me anytime. I would fly to Atlanta in a state of confusion because I was creating problems with marrying the wrong people and doing the wrong things. And I would get down to Doc's, and he'd just have me take my inventory, and he'd direct me. And he taught me and told me and showed me how to pray. Get on your knees, you sucker, and don't get up until you have done what you're supposed to do. And take time to listen when you're praying. Don't be just demanding. That doesn't work. He said, take time to let him give you what you need today. And Doc was good for me. And through Doc, I got to know hundreds and hundreds of people and went to conferences all over with him and done a tremendous amount. I'd leave my home or my car at their home in Atlanta and fly home. And I was single, and I'd go back a few weeks later and pick my car up and do a bunch of meetings, and away I'd go again. And Doc and his wife liked nude swimming and a lot of things that I enjoyed, and it was just awesome. Because in AA, I've learned that we can do most anything except drink, and I'm not successful at drinking. And I feel sorry for some people. Heard a guy the other day say, I wish they had a pill. Or if they had a pill, I'd take it and I could drink. I wouldn't care what they had. I wouldn't want to drink. No, life's too good. So it's truly a miracle that God has shown me a way to live where I can be responsible and have love. It used to be L-O-V-E to me, and that had conditions, and now I understand that love is just love, and it, you know, it's not a byproduct. And you know, if I'm not careful, I sometimes let that little boy overpower the big boy, because I'm Jeanette gets a little ticked at me. I'll say, well, I'm just a little boy dressed in men's clothing, you know, and sometimes I'm so childish, you know, I really am at times. But A has allowed me to, I can do anything. I mean, virtually anything but drink. To be asked here to speak, you know, it's a real opportunity. I could almost thank Milton now for having me speak. The time's growing close, but I could go on all day about the wonderful way of life that A's shown me and the friends and motor homes and the rewards, just the things that I'm allowed to have, and it's all if I don't drink, and I have nothing if I drink instantly. My son, my oldest boy, he's 40 now. He says to me one day, somebody said, "Is your dad not drink?" And he said, "Oh no, no." My dad would drink a truck a day. So he knows how quick I'd be out of business. I mean, we do have a lot of trucks, but it wouldn't take long. It would be because the first thing I'd do is get belligerent and lose my best people and the way. So long as I don't drink and come to meetings and hang out with the sober people, you know, I'll never forget when I got sober. I wasn't totally broke, but I had a little house and a big mortgage. I had two cars in the driveway, and they weren't new and shiny anymore, and I had a nice boat. And when I got sober, I had this hobby convertible, and I sold it because I knew I'd never be able to have a convertible without booze, because I'd never ever rode in a convertible without booze. And I sold my boat because I knew that you'd never ride in the boat without being drinking. And the police could prove that they had had many encounters with me and my boat, too. They used to police me into the harbor, and you know, I got rid of that stuff, and years down the road, the boats came, and they were better sober than they ever were drunk. And the convertibles came, and I had more fun. Everything was better sober, but I just had it all reversed. So I don't have a lot more to say. There's one little thing I have a lot to say as far as Alcoholics Anonymous. I could talk all day as to what's been so freely given. You know, it's unbelievable. I like this little, my sponsor, I'll tell you about my sponsor. My first sponsor died when I was about 5 years sober, and he had a friend, a Scottish friend, a belligerent Scottish, Scotsman. His name's John Dunbar. And John, one of the first times I ever spoke, I got all done and thought I'd done a great job. He said, it'll be good when you grow up a little bit and tell us about what it's like to be sober. We know how to drink in this fellowship. And I was so hurt, you know, because I thought I'd done such a great job. But you know, when Doug and John were friends, and when Doug passed away, he was the guy I wanted, because he never, ever, ever done anything for me that wasn't good for me. And he wouldn't care whose feelings he hurt or whatever. He's not that way. Loves to hug the ladies. Oh, John's a hugger. Anyway, he can recite this thing. And maybe I could, but I won't. And it's probably most of you have heard it, but I like this, and I just thought it would be nice for us to share this. The man in the glass. When you get what you want in your struggle for self, and the world makes you king for a day, then go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what that man has to say. For it isn't a man's father, mother, or wife whose judgment upon him must pass. The fellow whose verdict counts most in his life is the man staring back from the glass. He's the fellow to please, never mind all the rest, for he's with you clear to the end. And you've passed your most difficult, most difficult test if the man in the glass is your friend. You can fool the whole world down the pathway of years and get pats on the back as you pass, but your final reward will be heartache and tears if you've cheated the man in the glass. And I guess you could say woman. But to me, that, I've got to like myself, and it's not important that I search out everyone's approval. It's okay to just be me today. Don't drink, go to meetings. For the new people like Melissa, I'm so proud of her. But she's new, but her drinking will never be the same if she ever tries again. She's got the good stuff now. So once we know a good way of life, why would we want to go back to that other way? I sure don't want any part of it. And thanks again. It's a wonderful conference. I don't know if I'll be here in the spring. I don't know. I'm a little bit confused, but I love to travel, and I'm riding around and having a good time. And as long as I don't drink, I can probably continue to do it. Thanks very much.